You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Often when the subject of inner city poverty is discussed, the subject of parenthood comes up, and people are likely to ask why poor people choose to have children, sometimes without getting married, when supporting them is so difficult. How do single mothers survive on welfare? Why don't more fathers take responsibility for their children? Sociologists Catherine Eden and Timothy J. Nelson have investigated those questions and looked closely at the lives of poor parents in the inner city, particularly in one of the poorest cities in the country, Camden, New Jersey. Their book, Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City, is based on a multi-year study of low-income, unmarried fathers in Philadelphia and Camden, and shows how economic and cultural shifts have transformed the meaning of fatherhood among the urban poor. It's published by the University of California Press, and I'm very pleased that they can join us now for this week's installment of our series, Strapped, A Look at Poverty in America. Catherine Eden is Distinguished Bloomberg Professor in the Department of Sociology in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Timothy Nelson is Senior Lecturer and Research Scientist in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
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 Kathy, where do Camden, New Jersey, and the poorest neighborhoods of Philadelphia rank in terms of poverty?
Well, Camden continues to be America's poorest city. Philadelphia is one of the poorer cities in America, but certainly not anything like Pittsburgh or Cleveland. It's really Camden that's the poorest part of the Philadelphia metropolitan region. But both Philadelphia and Camden have very high rates of non-marital childbearing. Over 60% of all kids born in Philly and Camden are born outside of marriage. So it was a good place to begin our investigation of the parenting lives of inner city poor people.
Now, I would have assumed that the poorest city in the country would have been in the South. Forgive me for if that sounds a little bigoted. But Camden?
Well, you know, if you think back, Camden was really the epicenter of employment in central New Jersey. We all remember RCA Victor, which started in Camden, the New York shipyards, Campbell's Soup. All of these industries really left Camden in the 1970s. A series of riots weakened the city's economic base. The Cherry Hill Mall drew shoppers away. And what we have is a desperately poor city. Mainly African-American now, Puerto Rican. Most whites have fled. But you do have communities of entrenched white poverty in Philadelphia. And frankly, that's what brought us over the river, so we could tell a story both of African-Americans and whites living in inner-city poverty.
And you moved to Camden to do your research. What's it like to live there? You write that you couldn't get food deliveries and repairmen wouldn't come to your neighborhood. And there was a problem with garbage collection?
Yeah, one of the first things that we noticed, as soon as moving into East Camden, I went down to the local store to get a copy of the Philadelphia paper and was informed by the storekeeper that the delivery driver of that newspaper was afraid to come into the neighborhood. So, I mean, part of what we did, why we moved to Camden is just, for a couple of reasons, to figure out more what questions we should be asking of these parents, and really to subject ourselves to some of the same circumstances that they had to face on a daily basis.
Were you afraid?
Sure. at points we were afraid, but, you know, you kind of settle into the community and into community life more quickly than you think. I will say that it was depressing. I remember sometimes going to the Cherry Hill Mall just to sit, you know, near the Cinnabon store, just to sort of soak in some sense of normalcy. But people are people. We did have a couple of murders on the block the first year we moved in. It was the bloodiest year, actually, in Camden's history in terms of the murder rate. So it was a harrowing year. But in many ways, you know, you do your laundry and you care for your kids and you go to work every day, and so those aspects of life don't change, even though you're living in America's poorest city.
Well, it has to be depressing if a cinnamon store represents normalcy. You open your book with two influential reports, one by the former New York State Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan in 1965, the other by Bill Moyers in 1986. Can you describe what each of these showed and the consequences of these reports even decades later, Tim?
Well, the famous or infamous Moynihan report about the changing nature of the African-American family was, of course, a very controversial thing in, when it was released, but basically showed that the decline in the two-parent family in the African-American population. I think more central to what we were looking at was the Bill Moyers CBS special, The Vanishing Family, which kind of picked up where Moynihan left off, and actually portrayed one of the men in the video, a man by the name of Timothy McSeed, who has six children by different women, and is says some things to Moyers about his sort of lack of responsibility, saying essentially, "Well, what I don't do in terms of financial provision for my children, the government does." And this was a very unrepresentative, as we try to show in the book, portrayal of these inner-city unwed fathers.
Well, Paul Ryan recently has brought up the topic again in a different way than President Obama did, although in the end he also called for greater responsibility for young black men in a campaign speech he gave in 2007 when he said, "There are a lot of men out there who need to stop acting like boys, who need to realize that responsibility does not end at conception, who need to know that what makes you a man is not the ability to have a child, but the courage to raise one." Did that get any attention from the people you were studying?
It's interesting. I think oftentimes these public portrayals really rankle with the men that we talk to because the diagnosis that these reports imply is that, these men really don't care. They have children and selfishly flee. Any look at the data suggests this is not true. You have 80% of fathers still with the mother at the time of birth, most fathers involved with the kids, 60% still involved at age five. So, what we wrote this book to show, I think, is that the problem is much deeper than a lack of caring. It's not that we present a rosy picture. In fact, what we show is that while most fathers fail some of their children, they do eventually succeed at fathering through selectively fathering some of their children at any one time. So that's not exactly a rosy picture, but it's far different than the sort of fathers don't care prescription that many public commentators, including Obama, offer.
Were the stories and situations of having children outside of marriage similar among the white, Hispanic, and black men that you spoke with?
Yeah, I think what really unites, just to clarify, we did interview for the book 110 low-income fathers, roughly half of whom were African-American and half of whom were white. We did interview Hispanic fathers, but they're not in this particular book. But what unites, I think, across the racial groups is the fact that these were low-income fathers living in very poor urban neighborhoods and having essentially very similar responses to a pregnancy, especially a first pregnancy. We were very surprised by the very positive responses that these men had toward these pregnancies. And again, this is very much in contrast to the story of the hit-and-run father who, as soon as his girlfriend comes up pregnant, is, fleeing the scene. But these guys were very excited at the prospect of becoming fathers, and partly because everything else in their life was so negative. All the violence, all the poverty and despair of the neighborhood around them, the gang violence and so on. This was a chance for them to really do something, as they defined it, very positive in their own lives, and to really kind of actually had a redemptive quality is in the stories that they told.
For some of them, it was a matter of them being not having a good enough job to get married and bring up a family, and at the same time they wanted to have kids.
Yeah.
But that what kinds of jobs did the men you spoke with have if they had jobs?
Well, you know, the conventional wisdom, I think, now echoed by Paul Ryan is that there's sort of a culture of non-work in the inner city. But if you spend any time in the inner city, Milwaukee, Baltimore, or Camden, you'll soon find that everybody's working. First of all, these single mothers we've also written about have two sayings. You know, one is, I can do better myself. In other words, I'm not going to, you know, take him along with me. And second, if you don't pay, you don't stay. So men have to support themselves. They're not living off of women. But many times they're not working in the formal economy all of the time. In Philadelphia and Camden, a lot of the white guys are working informally in the shadow of the union economy as truck drivers and roofers and low-level construction workers. And they have connections with people in the construction trade, often from high school or from kin, who can provide them with these low-level jobs. African-American guys don't have those connections, so they're oftentimes relegated to day labor. And the competition for day labor work is so intensive that we had one group of seven African-American men in Camden who all bonded together using their cell phones, fanned out across the city at 5 in the morning to all of the day labor agencies, and then informed each other via cell phone of the day's offerings so they can make sure they got out to find work.
My guess,
even if it's a casual hustle, everybody's doing something almost all of the time.
My guests are Catherine Eden, distinguished Bloomberg professor in the Department of Sociology and in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Also at Johns Hopkins is Timothy Nelson, senior lecturer and research scientist at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. They have written a book together called Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City. It is published by the University of California Press. What are the statistics of American children being born outside of marriage these days?
Well, it's between 41% and 42%. So, you know, we used to think of this as sort of the tail of the distribution, but it's not the tail anymore. And that's up from about a third in 2000. So the numbers are increasing. But what's important about the American story, in contrast to the story in Europe, is that these births are heavily concentrated at the bottom of the income distribution. If you're a college graduate, your chances of having a non-marital birth are below 5%.
But in Europe, that's different.
Well, in Europe, it's not as class-linked. The other thing is that in Europe, their cohabitations are as stable as our marriages. In the U.S., we don't know how to stay together if we're not married. So cohabitations typically, and even among parents very quickly, among those who have a non-marital birth, as I said, 80% are in a relationship with each other when the child is born, but half those relationships break up by the time the kid is one, and you know, more than two-thirds have broken up by the time the child reaches the age of five, and that's much higher than the demise of marriages.
Tim, when you asked the men what the ideal circumstances to have a baby was, what did they tell you?
Well, this was very interesting because they had very sort of mainstream ideas about what was the ideal situation. So many of them said, oh, well, you should first of all be out of school. You should complete your schooling. Then you should get married. Make sure that you've got a decent job, and then you should have children after that. And then they would kind of wryly smile and say, well, of course, I didn't do it like that. You know, so it's not, I think sometimes the story that gets out there is that there are deviant sets of values in the inner city, and they just aren't, you know, kind of playing by the middle class way of doing things. So in terms of what they think is the ideal, I think is very similar to the middle class. But there's lots of reasons why they sort of say that I can't do it this way in my situation.
I want to return to this after we take a little break. My guests are Timothy Nelson and Catherine Eden. Their book, Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City, is published by the University of California Press. Stay with us. We are back with Catherine Eden and Timothy J. Nelson. Their book, Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City, published by the University of California Press. If the mothers and fathers of these children are teenagers and still in school, do they usually drop out?
Well, yes, some do drop out. You know, we usually think that the moms are the ones who drop out of school in the face of a pregnancy. We know from survey data that that's actually not true. Usually they've dropped out before they've become pregnant. But the dads do sometimes drop out. In fact, it's a common reason for dropping out that you want to get a job and help support your family.
A baby is a lot of responsibility. In many cases, makes life more difficult. But don't babies also represent hope to many people?
Yeah, yes, I think that's
exactly. Sorry.
Well, Tim, your turn. Get back to Kathy in a moment.
Okay. I think that is the number one thing that comes through when you talk to fathers about why they're so excited to become fathers is the sense of hope, as I said earlier, in often bleak circumstances, and a lot of confidence or at least, you know, determination that they're going to turn their lives around in the face of this pregnancy. And, you know, it doesn't always work out. Sometimes the problems are just too big. For example, a severe substance abuse problem. Sometimes he may be on his way to a stint in incarceration. Often the biggest problem is that his relationship with his child's mother is still pretty new when the pregnancy occurs, and it's still fairly shaky even after the child is born. And we all know sort of how stressful it is having a newborn. And often that's why those relationships don't last until the child's first birthday.
Well, we're still debating over whether contraception should be allowed in parts of this country, but many people have promoted abstention. Is that realistic with these people?
I don't think so. But I will say that, you know, when you ask your typical Camden teenager about contraception, one young woman said, well, it's like they have condoms hanging from the ceilings at my school. You know, young people generally felt that a lack of contraception wasn't really the problem. In fact, in the typical relationship, a young couple starts by using what they call double protection, both condoms and a female form of protection. But as the relationship grows, a common way that young men and women signal to each other that they're moving toward greater commitment is via condom disuse. One thing that's really important to remember, and I always tell this to my college students, is that in some ways, young people in the inner city see children as the key source of meaning and identity. So although they'll tell you, yeah, I know I need to wait till I get it together, they're almost chomping at the bit to become parents, to enter into the parenting role, and caring for a child is really seen as a key part of, you know, what makes life meaningful in the mid-20s. So our college students at Johns Hopkins think, oh, my gosh, you know, I don't want to become a parent anytime soon, but young people in the inner city are really eager for this experience.
And Tim, you write that many of these men see fatherhood as a reason to reform their behavior, a good excuse to clean up their lives. But does it usually work out that way?
You know, it often doesn't, especially for the children they have when they're still pretty young. And like I said, sometimes it's the magnitude of the problem that defeats them. Sometimes it's the lack of any kind of support in their lives. You know, but they do, you know, they do. There is a sort of a parenting thirst that we talk about that's really awakened with the first pregnancy. And maybe they don't get their lives together, the relationship breaks up, but they're still going to try again in a different relationship, perhaps with a different set of kids. And often that takes place when they're more stable, when they've got a better job, when they've kicked whatever habit that they have. So they often are able to turn their lives around in a second or subsequent pregnancy rather than a first one.
Well, do they see their inability to contribute substantially to their child's support as a failure?
I think, yes, in some ways they do, although, you know, part of the reason we call the book Doing the Best I Can is that the denominator for fathers is not necessarily the child's need, but, you know, what he is able to provide. So they don't see themselves as 50% responsible financially. In fact, we see this as kind of one problem of absentee parenting. It's very hard to get a sense of what it really costs to raise a child if you're not living with that child and caring for that child on a day-to-day basis.
Well, how many of these people were raised by single mothers?
Quite a few of them are raised by single mothers, but even those who are raised in two-parent homes with dads who fit the more traditional image of, you know, the paycheck dad, don't really get a break from their sons. These men are seen as little better than deadbeats who don't stay around for their kids because they were paychecks but not parents. And what our men really want to be is parents. Although they feel they should contribute as much as they can financially, what they really emphasize is the softer side of fatherhood. They think they should be there for their children, care for their children, be there for the first words, the first step. And most importantly, they really feel that they need to be their children's friends.
There have been campaigns over the years to encourage marriage among poor people because it's thought that it'll help lift people out of poverty. Has that turned out to be true?
Kathy? Well, you know, that's kind of funny. So when you ask poor people about marriage, you will find a great deal of enthusiasm. In fact, they'll tell you that they take marriage very seriously, and the reason they're not married is because they feel so strongly that marriage is a sacred institution. We argue in this book and in an earlier book I wrote about the moms in these same communities with Maria Kafalas that marriage among working class, poor, and middle class alike has reached a very high standard, right? We all agree across our culture that poor but happy marriages are unlikely to survive. We feel that marriage is now, to use Andrew Cherlin's words, a capstone and not a cornerstone. It's almost a sign of achievement, a form of consumption. And big weddings are back in the middle class, destination weddings. And the poor have responded to this rising standard of marriage, too. They not only want to, you know, be poor and scraping by and barely making it, they want the white picket fence dream first. And most importantly for our men, they want a soulmate. They fundamentally don't believe that anyone will love them through thick and thin. And they're looking for the woman who will say, no matter what, you know, and in the case of these guys, no matter what can mean a lot, I'm going to be there for you. So they're really holding marriage to a very high standard, in fact, so high that their own relationships don't quite live up to that standard.
My guests are Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson, both in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University and authors of Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City, published by the University of California Press. We're talking about this as part of our series called Strapped, A Look at Poverty in America. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Tim, did any of the men you spoke with tell you about whether there was a discussion of keeping the baby?
Can you clarify? What did?
Well, whether they discuss having an abortion or giving the child up for adoption.
I see. You know, it was very interesting. The men typically talked about, well, it's her body. I'm going to let her make that decision. So you can read this in different ways. One reading is these guys are all very sort of liberated and, you know, kind of taking that kind of stance about that. But the other way to read this is that really it puts all the responsibility on her. And thus diminishes some of his responsibility for what happens later. And so he's kind of putting her in the driver's seat. But this often comes back to haunt him later on, because after they break up, which, they often do, he kind of gets upset that she's acting like this child belongs to her. But he kind of set that dynamic in motion by really pushing all of that responsibility about what to do in the face of a pregnancy onto her.
But they do see the primary responsibility for raising the child as the mother's.
Yeah.
Once they've broken up, that's right.
Now, does having kids keep many of these men and women in the very poor communities Because if they didn't have anything keeping them there, might they move on to an area where there would be a better job or a safer life?
I don't think so. Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think we have any data on whether people who go without children are more or less mobile than those that have kids. I think what kids does is provides an opportunity for a turning point. So a 16-year-old boy in our study greets the news he's going to become a dad with the words, "Thank you, Jesus." And when you ask him, you know, what's going through his mind, he tells this story of his brother being killed, being murdered in the prior year, his mother returning to her crack addiction in response to the overcrowded household he lives in. He happens to be our neighbor during this year in Camden when there are all the murders, and, you know, he's just feeling all of the negativity of his neighborhood. And in some ways, you know, this possibility that's presented by this less than perfectly planned child is just salvation to him. You know, as he's talking to us, he looks down in his lap at his little girl, Julissa, and he looks back up again and he says, you know, "My daughter, she's the bomb." And now many years later, he's still very involved with his daughter. So I think even though it doesn't always work out, having children does, men seize on children as a potential to turn their lives around. And I think if we paired supportive services and especially jobs with that sort of magic moment of fatherhood, we might really see young men find avenues for, you know, sort of mainstream behavior that we haven't before. We've kind of failed to sort of realize that men are so positively disposed to children, and we haven't really done anything to try to capitalize on that good instinct to be generative, except, you know, assign men a child support obligation.
Well, Kathy, you've reported extensively on poverty and mothers. How did the stories you heard from poor single mothers compare with what these fathers told you?
Well, I started out talking to the moms, and I had been talking to the moms for a decade and a half. When two people kept saying, "You need to talk about the men." One was Tim, who's my husband and research partner on this project, and the other is a former colleague that I wrote about welfare with, Laura Lane, who's the dean of the School of Social Work at University of Michigan. And I said, "I don't want to talk to the dads. I already know everything there is to know about the dads, you know, from listening to the moms." And
so you were caught up in the stereotypes, just like everyone else?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so it was quite a revelation talking to these men and to realize how, you know, hard they were trying. In fact, after we wrote "Doing the Best I Can," we went sort of to the hard numbers, you know, national representative data sets. And because in the book we claim that men are really accomplishing fatherhood through this serial selective fathering, I wanted to see, you know, what the national numbers showed. And of all men in their late 20s who ever have a non-marital birth, over 80% are intensively involved. And when I say intensively, I mean several times weekly or daily with at least one of their biological children. So what's astonishing, right, is just as we haven't recognized that everybody's working in the inner city, we haven't realized the extent to which men are parenting. The tragedy, though, is that although, you know, almost 90% of guys are heavily engaged in parenting at least one child, half of these guys are leaving another child behind.
Well, how many of the fathers you spoke to, Tim, were the primary caretakers?
Just several. So in order to fit into who we talked to, you had to have a non-custodial child, in other words, a child you weren't living with. But, of course, given that men often had children with more than one mother, there were some who were the primary caregivers of one child or set of children, but also a non-custodial parent of another set. And it was really interesting to me to see how much these men who were primarily caring for their children looked like the mothers. In other words, they had to get their lives together or have these children taken away, just like moms do. And it's that kind of, you know, external pressure of having to do this, which often kind of makes guys behave in ways that they don't need to if they're the non-custodial parent.
Now, critics of social welfare programs believe government assistance makes people dependent. Kathy, did you see that among the women on welfare you interviewed in the 1990s? And did that extend to the people you talked about in this survey?
So, we had welfare reform in the mid-1990s, and the first book I wrote, Making Ends Meet, was about welfare on the eve of welfare reform. Back then, about 5 million households, 5 million adults were on the welfare rolls. And we had tried reform after reform, and we couldn't really budge the numbers. What we found in our, four-city study is the reason people weren't leaving welfare is you couldn't make enough money at work to survive, so instead you had to collect welfare and work at an underreported job. So the irony is that, people were on welfare, but everybody was also working. Now, all of that changed with welfare reform. We made it harder to get welfare, but we also added huge tax credits for the working poor that changed the calculus and made it pay to work rather than to receive welfare. You could actually live, escape poverty through a low-wage job if you could manage to hold that job full-time, full year. And, boom, millions of American single mothers went to work, and they've stayed there. Even in the face of the Great Recession, there were very few women on welfare. Right now, there are only 1.1 million adults on the rolls, many of those concentrated in Illinois, New York, and California. Some states only have a few dozen families on the rolls. So we've all but eliminated welfare. And what's interesting is we still hear this dependency rhetoric. We still hear about people being dependent on the government when welfare has largely disappeared, and most folks are working. And in fact, we actually studied the extreme poor in a more recent project, families living on less than $2 per person per day in America. And that number's doubled since welfare reform. And even among those families, 90% have had a worker in the last 2 years, and only 10% have collected a welfare check.
Just one more question, because we're pretty much out of time. Do you see anything hopeful or positive in your findings? And what do you see as the as coming out of the current situation where we've become much more polarized in the debate over these issues?
I'd say the most hopeful thing is something Kathy mentioned already, is that these fathers that we talk to, they really do want to be parents. They want to be connected to their kids. And I think in terms of what we can do to support that is we really have to talk about the visitation rights of unwed fathers, because by virtue of the fact that they have no marriage tie, they have no rights either.
And the law makes it harder for them to perform or to show responsibility for the children that they fathered?
Well, often just they have no access. There's the issues of gatekeeping by the single moms, sometimes for good reason, but mostly for just because of relational disputes and so on. And if a guy wants visitation rights, he has to go to a lawyer, which for these men is pretty much an impossible situation.
We have very little time, but I thought I'd sneak Jonathan in. Hi, Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Jonathan, can you make it quick?
Yes, I just wanted to say that I'm 26 years old. My ex-lady and I, we have a daughter, 2 years old, and it's very interesting because I actually went last week to file for a court hearing so I can get visitation for my daughter. Since we were together for 2 or 3 years, we were living with each other 2 years, I was taking care of everything financially. Her mom wasn't working. And since September to December, her mother saw her 2 days out of a week. She was with me. We used to drive over there, didn't ask for gas money or anything like that. Then from late January to February, her mother enrolled her into school. Then she came up with a plan for how we're going to split the week up. And I was cool with that. And about 3 weeks ago, she said that she didn't want to split Thursday. She wanted Thursday. So she wanted for me to have her Friday afternoon. Well, I'll pick her up Friday from the school.
We're getting bogged down in details here, Jonathan.
No
But let me ask my guests, does this sound typical?
Yeah. So at the end of the book, we call for treating poor dads like middle-class dads. Middle-class dads have court-enforced visitation rights. It's a matter of course when child support is assessed. Poor dads who usually give birth outside of marriage don't have those same rights. We also call for a national change of heart. All of us need to think of dads like Jonathan, not just as paychecks, but as parents with equal responsibilities, but also equal rights to their children.
And when he wants to see his child, his the mother can just simply say, no more Thursdays.
No more Thursdays, right? That's what needs to change.
Thank you both so much for being on our show, and thank you, Jonathan, for calling in. Catherine Eden, distinguished Bloomberg professor in the Department of Sociology in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Timothy Nelson, senior lecturer and research scientist in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. Their book, Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City, published by the University of California Press.